Welcome to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with Opera Holland Park's Director of Opera, James Clutton. In conversation with creatives and collaborators, we explore the process of putting opera on stage and how the artists involved approach their craft.
Hello, welcome to From the Producer's Office. I'm James Clutton, Director of Opera, Opera Holland Park. Welcome to the producer's home office. At the moment, it's June 2020. We all know what that means. I've got a great guest with me today. We're just going to dive straight in. Welcome, Peter Brathwaite. How are you, Peter?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
It's great to see you. We're going to go into this quickly. We're slightly delayed in starting this morning because what was your excuse, Peter?
I got trapped in a field by some cows. I wasn't expecting to see them there. I thought I'd have a sit down on my walk and realise that I couldn't actually get back the way I came. So
absolutely the best reason for anything being even. I mean, it was only a minute. It was only slightly delayed in any time I've ever heard. So that. We're going to talk about a few things as we go through. I'll say this in more detail later on, but something you've been doing has been one of the very few highlights through lockdown, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's go right back to the beginning. Growing up, did you grow up in a musical family? Was music around?
Music was around, not necessarily playing instruments, but a lot of singing. My sisters had sung in choirs and my mum had sung in Barbados as well. And there was a lot of listening to LPs and all sorts of things and singing together in the house and when I got a bit older, watching a lot of music videos as well. So yeah, that was the basis of my music at home.
Right. So no one professional?
No.
It's a great jump, that, because when I talk to people on here so often, that there was music around in the house, but there was no one professional doing it. And then it suddenly seems a massive jump for that person like you that becomes the professional. Did that feel strange at the time?
It did. I mean, my family have always been really supportive of what I've chosen to do. And that's been really great to have that enthusiasm for music and for opera. And for singing, there was no precedent. So we've got lots of medical professionals and teachers but no musicians at all. So the unknown and uncertainty of jumping into a profession like this was great. And we obviously felt it. And as I've navigated the profession and stuff, they've always been there to help me. And it's quite nice having that one step removed from the profession just to get a sense of reality and real life.
No, indeed. It can get very strange otherwise. I mean, I think that we all need that support and that outside eye as well, which is really helpful when it's, when you're stuck in the middle of it. I mean, I think, was there a moment where you thought, oh, music is a vocation, you're loving it, but was there a particular moment you think where you thought, oh, that could be a job, or did it just creep up upon you?
Yeah, it just sort of crept up on me. I was singing all the way through my childhood into my teenage years, and then I had choral scholarships and things. I was in National Youth Choir, and then when I got into the Royal College of Music, it was very exciting, and I was excited about singing and singing songs, and I was a huge Bryn Terfel fan and Fischer Dieskau, and had all their albums, and that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to go there and sing Vaughan Williams and Schubert and be completely absorbed in that world. And as soon as I got there, I realized that actually it's a bit more serious than that. I'm here doing a postgraduate course, and they're training us up to go and be professional musicians. Yeah. And it was at that point that I had to try and work out what I was there for and for myself, where I wanted to go with singing. And so that was quite a difficult time to navigate.
You were aware of that at the time though, Peter, where you were aware that that was a thought process that you had to have.
Yeah, I think so. And so applying for the opera course, that was with the intention of trying to have an operatic career, and so I definitely felt the importance of that whilst I was there, and tried to just get as many opportunities as I could, and really make the most of the facilities and the teaching and the exposure and that amazing theatre that they've got there.
Great
being
theater,
in productions.
Yeah.
And yeah, so yeah, it suddenly became much more complicated and serious than university life, which
but you were singing through university as well, though.
Yes, yeah, I was singing at Newcastle Cathedral, and I was in the university choirs, and I was just about still in National Youth Choir at the start of university. But yeah, completely absorbed in music throughout my university life.
It does take you over, doesn't it? I mean, yeah. that's a little link into the with the choirs you're talking about, because obviously we are June 20 at the moment. Choirs devastated across the country.
Yes,
all the opera houses and everyone. Apart from just the pressure that's put on all of us, how have you been coping with that as a singer? Because you know you are a singer, you are a performer. You haven't been able to do that. How has it been, and how have you been coping with that?
It's incredibly difficult, and it feels as if you've lost a part of yourself because you can practice as much as you want in a room. I'm sat here now in my music room, and this is where I learn my music, and I try and work on vocal things that I'm trying to solve. And so my whole life revolves around this art and what I do. And it's more than just being in a practice room. It's working with other musicians and collaborating. And that's the hardest thing at the moment, just not to be with other musicians and creatives. And
it is, a lot of people talking to me, obviously, because I've said this a lot, but I never realized how difficult it would be to unproduce a season as it is to produce one. I mean, it's just been terrible taking it apart. And the day I rang up, because we had to cancel our 2020 season, the day that decision was made, and I was trying to call as many people as possible. In the end, I ran out of time. I just couldn't do it. I had to email some. But it was pretty horrific doing it. And I got very emotional at the end of when I actually stopped and just sat down for, you know, I and all of my team have spent 18 months on that season.
Yeah.
All of those people, singers, directors, conductors, designers, stage manager, had all been working up towards it. And then suddenly in the space of a couple of hours, I'd called it all off. And it just, everyone only ever sees the show, don't they, really, which is what the business is. But there's so many people and so much work that goes into it in a communal way in the rehearsal room. The rehearsal room, I love being in the rehearsal room.
Yes.
And that communal work ethic and just pulling things together, it's just a great time, isn't it?
Yeah, and you see in yourself the progression, and you feel it in the room and in the space and what you're creating, and that's such a crucial moment in the process. And before you reveal it to an audience, and the thought of not being in a rehearsal room for a very long time is the worst thing at the moment. So it's a case of coming to terms with that and having hope that soon, hopefully things will improve. And
I mean, we're hoping, aren't we? I mean, I think that we've got this outside space that we're trying to utilize as soon as possible, really.
Yes.
To do something, because I think that there becomes a point where it becomes easy not to do anything, because we're just I really don't want us to get used to not doing anything.
Yeah,
it has to be a break with us as artists and management to say, let's do something, to get something going, to create that buzz again, because it is an exciting thing. Have you been able, mentally to just carry on, working with your voice and warming up and doing stuff, or has it been one of those times you just thought, I just can't face it at the moment?
Yeah, there was a time at the very start where I just stopped for a few days, and I just had to let it all sink in. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I still had a contract in the diary for August.
Right.
And I've since found out that that has been postponed until next year. So I was trying to get ready for that production in the thick of lockdown, which was really hard, because getting the motivation and obviously not being with coaches. And so I was doing a lot of it on my own. And it was actually a good thing for keeping me motivated during the time, because I knew that I had to learn some notes and work on a part and do the research. So that was really helpful. But the moment I found out that was postponed, was a huge thing, because then it suddenly dawned on me that, oh, right, that's the last of my big contracts for this year gone. So since then, I've been doing little sort of micro practice sessions. This morning was a slightly longer one, but I'm finding that first thing in the morning, even though it takes a bit more warming up, I'm more focused and I can do an efficient practice session, even if it means just singing something that I enjoy singing and doing some warming up and getting the voice moving, because that's the fear. And I'm sure lots of other performers feel like this. It's not performing. You lose that performance muscle. Yeah. And so it's every practice session I'm trying to build in just a couple of moments where I'm imagining I'm in a performance, and it's not just me practicing. It is really, really tricky.
I think it's really great you're doing that, because I think that there is a thing about, any of those, that muscle memory of performance, particularly dancers. I speak to a lot of dancers who are having that trouble about keeping in the right shape and fit, and sports people, just seeing the Premier League come back, and you can see that even though they've been training, there's some people that it hasn't been the same as doing.
No.
That's been a really weird thing. And so I think it's really important what you're saying there. And I think it's good for the wellness and the mental well-being as well to be like that, because, God willing, we're going to come back some point.
Yes.
And you have to be ready for it. And
definitely.
And I think it's great. I mean, you said about losing some contracts there, as everyone has this year.
Yeah.
I know how busy you were, because I kept offering you jobs and I can never get you. You're always so busy. But this year was a really busy year for you. And it was a lot of new work as well, as I remember. You made a real thing about that. Why has that happened to you? Is that just something you really push forward, or did you just have a natural affinity to do new work?
I've sort of fallen into it. I really enjoy it. I love the challenge of learning contemporary repertoire. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy the stories that are being told through these contemporary pieces. So especially this year, I was meant to be doing an operatic adaptation of a huge novel by Richard Powers called The Time of Our Singing. And it's a 50-year epic story of one family's lifetime.
Right.
And it takes in huge moments in world history and specifically American history. Mm. And just reading that book and doing the research was hugely enlightening, and and then putting opera on top of that was a really exciting prospect. So I love that combination of...
Where was that going to be, Peter?
That was going to be in Belgium at La Monnaie.
Lovely house.
Would have been the season opener and quite an important premiere. And but thankfully, it's on for next year. And the other thing was in Denmark, and that was based on a Peter Handke poem, and it was created more or less in the rehearsal room last year. We did lots of workshops and we were just going to be finishing it off and still rehearsing for the full 5 weeks or so this spring. We were meant to be doing that and tweaking things and working with a community chorus who were going to be inserted into the action as well, and working with actors and dancers. And I really love the collaborative aspect and putting unexpected combinations of artists together, and that happens a lot in contemporary music. But that's not to say that I don't love the traditional repertoire as well. I seem to have fallen into a pattern of doing.
I think particularly at the moment, or the last few years, that when composers or management see someone that can do it, because there's often a lot of pressure on new pieces with having to deliver straight away, and often. They're not even finished at the time you start getting them. And so you absolutely need people that can react quickly and sight read well and just get on with stuff and learn it. So I think that as soon as you've got a reputation for it, you keep getting asked for it, that's for sure. But no, I think it's a great stuff. And I think that there's going to be a need to have more contemporary work in the repertoire when we all get back anyway.
Definitely. Yeah.
Because of financial forces, contemporary stuff does often have smaller orchestras, not exclusively, of course, but has smaller orchestras. And I think that we just need to be utilizing that when we're all back. So I think in a funny way, the contemporary music will come in more and more to theatre's programming.
Yeah, I believe so as well.
I think we need to as well. Also for the audiences, I think the audiences will probably be a bit younger coming in, for the first little bit at least. And I think it's a good chance to use those people and get them in and really sort of
definitely
entertain them, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. And I think that because we've only actually worked together once when you did the Fanchula for me at Holland Park. But even that in a funny way was not, one of the Puccini's best known operas, and people come into it fresh then, so that was quite nice.
Yeah, that was a brilliant production. I really enjoyed it.
We had great fun. I was talking to Neil Cooper just the other day. I was taking the mickey out of his costume actually, because his trousers were so tight.
Yeah, all those tassels.
we often have a laugh about that. Let's move on a bit. You're also a BBC New Generation artist. What did that involve, Peter?
So I applied to the scheme. I seen that they were looking for new voices for presenting and ideas. And I applied to it and fortunately got on. So over the past year or so, I've been doing Time Travelers, which is a segment on essential classics and their quirky bits of music history. So they take a while to find and work out how you're going to put them together, but they're really fun to do, and that's been a great insight into radio work and developing my writing as well, which is something that I quite enjoy doing, and also just finding things that I didn't really expect to find. And I've been very keen over the past year to look for stories from the northwest of England, where I'm from. So I bumped up the quota for Manchester/Lancashire stories on the Time Traveller segment.
Absolutely. Great. I was going to ask you about that. We might as well touch it now, but because you have been writing articles for The Guardian and working broadcast on the BBC. Once again, was that a conscious decision to have a sort of wider power base to work from different things rather than just the singing, which is obviously takes up most of your time, but was that a conscious decision?
Yeah, that was a conscious decision around 2013-14. I was just starting to build the contacts and get offered slightly bigger roles, and I was very aware of the gaps in my diary, and that worried me. And I thought, well, this was mentioned at college a bit, the idea of building a portfolio career, and I enjoy doing other things, and I find that if I do something else, it often feeds into my singing anyway. So everything interlinks, and even if you don't see it at the very beginning, it pans out and you start to see the connection. So around that point, I decided that I would try and create my own performance, a bit like a recital, but slightly different, and look at repertoire that was not performed as much as some of the well-trodden classics. And through that, it was called Degenerate Music. And
it's on my next note to ask you about. I love this project. That was a good segue, Pete. Degenerate music banned by the Nazis, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, so that was a project, and it's still something that I'm really passionate about. And whenever I find something or get a lead, I'll add it to the project. And it's basically to recover lots of the music that was suppressed or banned by the Third Reich. Mm. And it's based on the exhibition that the Nazis held in 1938 in Dusseldorf called Entartete Musik. And it was an exhibition of all of the music that they thought was bad for German culture. And this was primarily music by Jewish composers, but also music that was influenced by jazz and popular music of the day, atonal or untraditional music. And it was placed during a week of national music making in Germany. So this was this exhibition was surrounded by all of the nationalistic music that they were celebrating. And so it stood out as a as an event. And actually, by this point in Germany, it was the only place that the general public could listen to the music that they actually enjoyed, because it was all banned on the radios and everything. And so they queued around the block to get in, and it was a huge success. And it had the like the allure of being forbidden and risque. And
what year was that, Peter?
That was 38. And they had a parallel art exhibition as well. So so my recital combined images of composers like they did in the original exhibition with some of the propaganda read out in between the songs and information, spoken information that I gave the audience as to the lives of the composers and things, and putting all the information on the table just to show them that actually, yeah, this was completely absurd, and these composers are great and worthy of being included in the canon. And
there's some really wonderful music around that time.
You
know, I'm very fond of it myself, on a purely selfish and personal basis, because my first ever hit as a producer was Vile and Brecht's A Happy End with the Bilbao song and Survive Johnny, and I had a big hit with that on the Fringe. It was my first show as a producer, and that first show as a producer I had a big hit with, and it's just so atmospheric, that music. As soon as you hear it, you sort of transported to a place that you only know by films or
whatever,
but you're just there, and it's just an incredibly evocative period of music. And I don't know if you saw that TV series Babylon Berlin. Did you watch that?
Yes, yeah. The dance scenes in that, the club scenes are amazing. They're just
incredible, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, I do like what they did with it and sort of had that old fashioned thing, but then sort of, you know, modernized it in different ways and just really made it, you know, very clubby. And
definitely.
You know, I thought it was an amazing piece of work. And so so that's still an ongoing project for you, Peter, is it the...
Yes, yeah. And it links into all the things that I'm concerned about, and in terms of the marginalized and people whose voices haven't been heard, and putting them back into the mainstream and giving them a platform. And it's a really important strand of my work, and hopefully it can develop over the years. And
it's an amazing project, and I think that it's something that, you know, just that can educate people by default in a funny way, you know, by stealth, you know, just doing it an evening of entertainment, and then they find out more as they're watching it as well. I think it's always the best thing. So you lead on to the different strands you work. What I said in the introduction here, through lockdown, I said this before we started, there's only really been three highlights for me on the social media or television. One has been Emily Maitlis asking questions on Newsnight. One has been Sophie Ellis Bextor's Friday Night Discos in her kitchen with her kids going mad. And the third one, and the longest running, is your project on the Getty Museum portrait. Do you want to talk a bit about it? Because when we post this podcast up, we'll put some of your links up. It's one of the most extraordinary things ever. If only social media was always like this. One of the most incredible projects I've ever seen. Do you want to just talk about it quickly?
So the Getty Museum in LA put a call out to the general public to recreate their favorite pieces of artwork using only what they had around the house. So household items to recreate their favorite pieces of art. And I took on this challenge when it first started. I'd seen the hype and been really impressed by the images that were popping up on social media. And I think it was Louise Kemeny, the soprano, who posted the girl with the pearl earring. And I thought it was beautiful as a recreation. And I thought, well, what can I find that I can recreate? And this was during a week where I think I'd had my first cancellations and postponements. So I was looking for a diversion, and dressing up seemed like a good way to take my mind off things.
Always.
Yeah. So I came across this image and I thought, well, I wonder what can I start with? And I found this image of a black servant in the 18th century. And I really liked it because he had a little dog with him and he was holding a silver goblet and he had a huge smile on his face. And I thought, well, I'll try to do that one. And yeah, maybe I'll do one more. And yeah, here I am 63 later.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I mean, but you, did you study art history at university or something?
I studied fine art at Newcastle University, yeah, along with philosophy. So it was a practical course. There was a bit of art history in there, but my focus was drawing. So, and focusing on life drawing and the human form. And so that was very much a big part of my life through school and through my university life as well. So when I moved to London, I stopped drawing completely because I found that I couldn't sustain the intensity of singing and doing art at the same time, visual art. So it was something that I just pushed aside and thought, well, maybe when I'm much older, I'll get into art again. I still go to galleries, so it's okay. And that's something that I've been doing over the years. I love going to art galleries, and whenever I travel, I try and go to the gallery in the city that I'm in, or if I'm working abroad, and I do the same as well. And so this has been a really amazing period of rediscovery for me, and that's why I use the term rediscovery, because it's more about my connection with art and having lost it for a bit. It's come back during lockdown, and that's been a great thing to come out of this period. And
well, you're having to research all these paintings, aren't you?
Yes, yeah. So
did you know many of them before, or
I knew a few of them, and researching the ones that I did know has enabled me to branch out and find these new ones. And but as I progressed through the dozens, and it's become more challenging to find new images, so I've become more and more inventive with my search terms on on the internet, trying to find different leads. And but doing that has opened up a whole array of artwork that I didn't know existed, and seeing these black sitters and subjects, the progression through time from being depicted as exotic accessories through to being depicted as real individuals with stories and backstories, I think is really interesting to me. And the way that you see the gaze changing from them looking at their master or looking off to an unidentified point in the distance somewhere to looking directly into the eyes of the viewer. Right. And that's really powerful to me. And so it's a whole seam of art that has been marginalized and isn't in the mainstream. And we can learn so much about history and the present day from it as well.
Absolutely. But I mean, the thing also for me is that your eye on it is just incredible, because the detail, you know, anyone listening to this has either seen all this work or is going to rush off to it now because it's sort of, but your eye for detail on this, I mean, you've got a better prop store in your house than we've got in our theatre. I don't know where you find them. But it's also the thing of having the idea of what those things could be. Because, you know, you, for anyone who hasn't seen any of this project, it's about replacing, as you say, everyday objects into this thing. And but that's a hard job, isn't it? You must have to really work at it.
Yeah, it's pretty challenging. And I think the thing that has given me a way into it has been attaching my family tree research that I was doing at the start of lockdown and I've been doing before into the project. And it's become a way of articulating that and visualizing it in a way that you can't really do when you're just filling in names on a family tree. And so lots of the recreations have revolved around a couple of items. One that you can see on this on our Zoom behind me, which is the patchwork quilt from my grandmother, and the other is something called a cuckoo stick, which is used to stir the national dish of Barbados, and it was carved by my grandfather. And these two items are really valuable and precious to me because I never met my grandparents, so it's right. The things I have of them and what yeah. I imagine they were like through, and so they've become quite key motifs, almost like musical elements to the pictures, and have given me a way into recreating these and giving some meaning for myself, and also having a conversation with this history as well. And so yeah, they usually form the basis, and then it's a case of getting creative with bits of card. And I've created so many things with pillowcases that I'm pretty proud of that, actually, and I'm sure my mum would be proud that I've been ironing pillowcases a lot in my lockdown.
yeah. But I think it is. I mean, I think if no one's taken it, yeah, I mean, it's got to be a book or something, because I think that it's just, I really, you know, being funny at the start, but I really mean it. It's one of the best art projects I've seen probably ever, you know,
that's very kind of you. Thank you.
It's just an amazing thing. When you start looking at it, you can't stop. You just have to keep looking at the next one, and you know, what's it going to do? And I thought you were peeking a little while ago. It looked like you were coming to stop, and you said, "I think your favourite one's out," and now you know, and you carried on. You know, you can't stop now. It's going to go ages. You know,
it's really difficult to stop.
But no, it's been a real pleasure to look at and see the sort of journey of. So what's next for you, Peter? Now, if you say most people like us, we haven't got anything exact in the diary immediately, but have you got things in the mid to long term that are still there at the moment, or is it all starting again?
It's next year, hopefully, there are things happening. So I hope to be in a rehearsal room from January. There's something that hasn't been announced yet. So, but then, who knows what will happen. And I'll be at La Monnaie next year for the opera that was postponed. And I'm just looking to try and fill out this this future and see what comes up. And
well, I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next, and I'm going to get you back at our place as soon as I can. You
know, I'd love to come back.
We keep on asking, but you're so busy. But Peter, thanks for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure, and I, as I say, you're giving a lot of people a lot of pleasure over lockdown in the midst of a really awful time for everyone. So thanks for that. But
thank you very much. Thanks
for coming on today, Peter.
It's great to be here, and thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, mate.
You have been listening to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with James Clutton. For more information on Opera Holland Park, please visit www.operahollandpark.com.